live from our nation's capital.
All talk here in Washington, D.C. turns to President-elect Joe Biden's administration. Speaker Pelosi has beat the political odds and reclaimed the gavel. We're talking right now about 2024 jockeying amongst Republicans.
Bloomberg Sound On. The insiders, the influencers, the insights.
Biden has promised again and again that he will unite the country.
The only way things happen is if Republicans and Democrats work together.
Unfortunately for President-elect Biden, this is a time when he's getting the most support he's going to get in the Democratic Party.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
House Democrats to open Trump's impeachment Wednesday unless Pence acts. Meanwhile, my exclusive interview with Dr. Deborah Birx. How did the events of last week impact the vaccination rollout? A lot to get through. We begin tonight, of course, with the big developments coming from the nation's capital. Diving into my Bloomberg terminal, my colleagues Billy House, Eric Wasson, and Stephen T. Dennis report. House Democrats Monday introduced a resolution to impeach President Donald Trump for a second time, setting up a vote this week unless Vice President Mike Pence uses his constitutional authority to remove the president. A majority of the Democratic-controlled House has signed on to the resolution, led by Representatives David Cicilline, Jamie Raskin, and Ted Lieu, charging Trump with inciting the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. It seeks to both remove him from the presidency and prevent him from ever holding office again. We've got sound on this topic that was the talk of the town all throughout the weekend. First up, Senator Pat Toomey on Fox. Here's the Republican from Pennsylvania.
Does not look as though there is the will or the consensus to exercise the 25th Amendment option. And I don't think there's time to do an impeachment. There's 10 days left before the president leaves anyway. I think the best thing would be a resignation.
As Republicans continue to call on President Trump to resign, Democrats are suggesting another course of action, and we've got sound on that as well. Here's Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to ABC.
Every minute and every hour that he is in office represents a clear and present danger, not just to the United States Congress, but frankly to the country. We have to understand that what happened on Wednesday was insurrection against the United States.
Meanwhile, legal scholars are openly debating about if there is another impeachment, as is likely. What would the timetable be for a trial in the Senate? Mick Mulvaney was asked about that on Fox. Here's sound on that.
Last year, the impeachment was a witch hunt. It was a political thing. They were looking for an excuse to impeach the president forever. Now it's different, and I think it would be looked at very differently by members of both the House and the Senate.
Lester Munson is a principal at the government relations firm BGR Group, as well as a former senior advisor to the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee under Chairman Bob Corker. And Jeannie Sean Zeno is a Bloomberg political contributor. She is an Iona College professor and the author of the new book, American Democracy in Crisis. I cannot wait to read it, Jeannie. But first, let me get your reaction about the path of a second impeachment and the timetable for a trial likely now after President-elect Biden is sworn in.
Yeah, there is real division among scholars and legal scholars on this question. People like Cass Sunstein, who I respect an awful lot from Harvard, who say, you know, impeachment is really only for current office holders. There's others who say, and I happen to agree with this school of thought, as long as he was impeached prior to leaving, the trial could be held after he left office. But of course, that raises a host of challenges for the incoming administration. And the question then is, do you put it off 100 days, as was suggested over the weekend? Do you hold it right away, which means the administration can't deal with other pressing issues like you're going to be talking about today, the pandemic? So a lot goes into sort of the thought process on this. I think he could be impeached and the trial could be held after constitutionally, which would allow them to make the case that he can't be, that he can't serve again. But I do understand that there's real division among scholars on this.
Jeannie, let me follow up with you here, because in terms of the purpose of a trial, it is, of course, to find fact and to get things, for lack of a better word, submitted for the record, for there to be a declarative narrative, for there to be an investigation, all of which are incredibly important when, as I spoke to one source today who told me, schools, nearby schools last week were evacuated because of the bombs that were found in the DNC, outside of the DNC and the RNC. There is still an investigation, an active investigation into who fundraised for this, who advertised for this. And so how important is it that there actually be a process that is followed through, Jeannie, for this to come to completion?
It's absolutely critical. And this is a major concern I have. You know, you see this push, understandably so, given all the circumstances that and what people lived through last week. And of course, the videos coming out this weekend, stunning for somebody like me who wasn't in DC like you were, Kevin, to see it. And, you know, just to imagine what these people experienced, you want there to be swift justice. But you also need there to be thorough justice. You need to uncover the facts of what did and did not happen, who was responsible, and those people need to be brought to justice. One concern I have about this timetable and doing this quickly is that we won't get all those facts on the table, and the people who should be held responsible won't be held responsible. Now, of course, impeachment is not the way we do it legally. These people can be held legally responsible, barring some sort of pardon at the federal level. And of course, impeachment is a political remedy for this.
It really is, again, just a very quickly moving story. And one of the developments that we are monitoring this hour is the Republican House Caucus conference call in which GOP leader Kevin McCarthy is saying reportedly that President Trump does bear some responsibility for last week's riot. Again, remarkable developments in terms of where the Republican Party, where the leaders of the Republican Party are at. Based upon my own reporting today and talking with at least two Republican sources who are key advisors to prominent individuals in the party, they're all trying to work through where the Republican Party goes in which direction and which turning point, for lack of a better word, they should respond to, and who, in fact, is leading the Republican Party today. Lester Munson, of course, is with us. He is a principal at government relations firm BGR Group. He's worked for top Republicans. Lester, what are you hearing from your Republican colleagues, staffers, senior advisors, legislative directors, LAs, about the direction of the party and the mood of the party this Monday?
It's a great question, Kevin. I think people are all over the place. They're unified in their shock and horror over what happened last week, and their concerns about safety, of course. But politically speaking, the next steps are not clear cut for Republicans. I think there is a sense among a lot of people that there has to be a reaction to what happened. You can't let it stand unanswered. What is essentially an attack on the legislative branch by the leader of the executive branch, you know, metaphysically, if not actually physically himself. So I think there's a lot of sorting out that has to happen, and it has to happen quickly. Members in the House, you know, as they come back together early this week, are going to look at each other face to face or perhaps over virtual calls and have to talk about what their constituents are saying, what their principles are, and the way forward for the party. It's a real crisis in the party. Notably, the Senate is not in session this week. They're not coming back until next week. So I think we're likely to see a less frantic and hopefully more sober and sensible answer from the Senate next week. Right now in the House, there's a lot of churn, there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of voices, and I think they're gonna struggle with coming up with a path forward for the party right now.
And even Lester, as you were making those comments, a red headline crossing my Bloomberg terminal right now: Fox News is reporting that Acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf is stepping down, and in a letter to DHS employees, he writes, quote, "I am saddened to take this step, as it was my intention to serve the department until the end of the administration." Again, Fox News headline crossing my Bloomberg terminal: Acting Head of Homeland Security Chad Wolf is stepping down. Lester Munson, another person.
Can I just offer a thought on that? I'm not sure that's a great move by Chad Wolf, but I'll tell you, in agencies right now in the executive branch, there are a number of political appointees who would like to leave. They would like to signal their outrage over what happened last week. And they are being urged by career folks not to leave, because the career folks are concerned that they would be replaced by people who are less well-grounded in reality, if you follow me.
No, I do, and it's real.
There's a lot of pressure on these folks to be present and to make good decisions, and I'm talking about Trump political appointees, to stay and try and do the right thing for these last 10 days.
And folks, in terms of if it sounds that you almost can't follow that, I get it. But that the dynamic that Lester just explained is the situation of so many Republican staffers in this moment, countless, virtually every single source that I've spoken to on the Republican staffer front since last Wednesday is in the predicament, for lack of a better word, and I it's the wrong word, Lester, that you just outlined. Quickly, in 30 seconds, Jeannie, before I gotta jump to a break. I mean, I'm up against a hard stop here. I mean, your response to what the situation of many of these appointees is right today, Jeannie.
Yeah, I mean, Lester and you both bring up an excellent point, which is, you know, not just who is going to replace these people, which is important enough, but in my mind, you're talking about the defense of the United States. As you have this kind of turnover at this late date, how insecure does that leave us in the wake of what we saw the other day in terms of what happened with the Soviet breaking into many of our systems, the Soviet Union, obviously, the breach on the Capitol, and so many things that have gone on. I do think there are real questions in terms of our security, both internally and externally, and these don't help.
All right, coming up, we're going to talk much more about this, plus my exclusive interview about how the events of last week impacted the vaccination rollout with Dr. Deborah Birx. I'm Kevin Cirilli. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. Coming up, my exclusive interview with Dr. Deborah Birx on an update for the vaccination rollout. Meanwhile, we are following multiple fronts still on Capitol Hill this evening as Republicans in the House gathered on a conference call in order to assess the situation, as we are now just a day and a half away from there likely being another impeachment vote in the House of Representatives. And it will be fascinating to see the split in the Republican Party and whether or not moderate Republicans vote to impeach. Again, the biggest legal variable tonight is trying to work through whether or not a Senate impeachment trial will occur after President-elect Joe Biden is sworn into office. That's the legal constitutional fight, not even fight, that's being explored this evening, that we will continue to weigh closely, to monitor closely, especially with the Senate not being in Washington, D.C. They're not convening. So Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, people still wondering what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will do. Obviously, we will keep you posted as that news breaks. Joining me for the hour, Bloomberg political contributor Jeannie Shawn Zeno, a Iona College professor and the author of the new book, American Democracy in Crisis, and Lester Munson, principal at government relations firm BGR Group, previously worked for the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee under Chairman Bob Corker. Lester, I was looking at the headlines when I was prepping for this evening's show, and when I knew that you were going to be on, I thought I have to get what I think, unfortunately, is an angle to this past week that we haven't spent enough time talking about. And that is what image America is projecting to the world this week. And as Bloomberg has reported, I've got it right up in front of me on my terminal, the World Health Organization team is set for a China trip this week and to meet with China officials from the World Health Organization to go over what happened with COVID-19. But Lester, as the images of last week's insurrection on Capitol Hill, the videos play out on social media, the horror, the tragedy, very real, What image from all of your experience in the geopolitical world did America project last week?
Well, Kevin, it does have an impact. You know, one of the things the United States likes to do in the developing world, which I think is a positive thing, is promote democracy and human rights, promote the values we believe in, the values that we think make America a special place. The events of last week do make that a much harder task. And so our diplomats, our agents abroad, our development professionals, their jobs advocating for our values got much more difficult last week. One of the things that I saw that was pretty telling was a tweet from the president of Zimbabwe, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is no Democrat. He's a human rights abuser. He does all kinds of terrible, nasty things. So bad, in fact, that even the Trump administration sanctioned him. He's calling for an end to those sanctions because he's, according to him, I don't agree with him, but he can now say, hey, who are they to judge me? Look what's going on in Washington. There's no way they should be allowed to punish poor little Zimbabwe when they behave that way. And there's a little bit of truth in what he's saying. And that's terrible, and it's shocking, and it's very regrettable.
Can you, before I bring in Jeannie to this, can you explain the horror about what those images mean to individuals serving around the world, in addition to the brave men and women serving in the military, but also at embassies all around the world, Lester?
Sure. These are Americans who are, you know, perhaps they don't have combat boots on, but some of them are serving in very difficult environments in countries where the standard of living is not terrific, where they're almost on hostile ground. They're advancing American interests. They're promoting our values. They're living a relatively difficult life for their country. They're public servants, and this makes their job so much harder. For an ambassador or senior diplomat to then go to their host country and say, you know, we've got concerns about your democratic procedures, or concerns about corruption, or concerns about the way you're treating the human rights of your own people. It's much more difficult to make that case now after what we saw last week. And unless there's a real consequence in Washington, frankly, for what the president said and what his allies did on Capitol Hill, that job is going to be more and more difficult. And let's be very realistic here. We've got a near peer competitor in China that does not share our values. They're going to exploit this. They're already exploiting it in Hong Kong, where 50 plus democratic activists have been arrested. This is going to make it more and more challenging to advance our interests around the world, which, you know, has a direct impact on our prosperity. We need to advance our interests around the world to maintain our standard of living here in the United States. The job just became much harder. Joe Biden's going to have to wrestle with that when he takes office.
Jeannie, quickly, unfortunately, I mean, you hear that, and it seems like there has to be significant changes.
There definitely does. And this is not just what happened in the last week. Let's not forget, as far back as before the last election, we had data out of Pew Research Center showing that amongst our closest allies, the views of the United States are at an all-time low. And that continues to get worse in the last few days.
Really important point. Coming up next, Dr. Deborah Birx. I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. Coming up, an exclusive conversation with Dr. Deborah Birx. Earlier this afternoon, I spoke with Dr. Deborah Birx. She, of course, is the Coronavirus Response Coordinator at the U.S. State Department. And I asked her about how the events over the last week have impacted the ability for her and her team to do their jobs. Let's roll the sound on that.
Well, I mean, the most important thing is we're focused on the virus all the time. But of course, any kind of disruption like this that really pushes people to the limit, increases more anxiety. It's difficult for everyone, difficult for Americans here and difficult for Americans around the globe. We've tried to stay very focused on working with the states to really combat the virus, but I think it was a shock to everyone.
And as you look forward in terms of vaccine distribution, Dr. Birx, where are we right now on the vaccination front and making sure that every American can get a vaccine?
Well, you know, it's really a really important question right now because I know you can see what's happening. The really explosion of cases that we saw in the Northern Plain states and the Rocky Mountain states in the September-October timeframe has moved into the more populous states of California and across the Sun Belt into Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee. And this is really a very important time that states both increase their mitigation because the rate of spread is much higher with this current fall surge into winter surge. And vaccination and ensuring vaccination, both of our frontline healthcare workers, but also particularly vulnerable Americans over 65, will be essential. And we can see now certain states are having great success in moving forward. We see West Virginia really immunizing almost 6 to 7% of their adult population, focused on really the vulnerable individuals as well as healthcare workers. But we also see a really good healthcare worker immunization program in North and South Dakota. So we're trying to bring all of that information together, really from the operational aspects in the field, and get that out to all governors so they can learn from one another.
What are some states that, and I don't really want to politicize this, but what are some states that are struggling right now or that are in the middle of reversing course, so to speak, to follow states that have crack the code, for lack of a better phrase, to get folks immunized?
Well, first, I think it's really difficult right now for governors and health officials around the United States. This virus is moving very rapidly. The rapid acquisition of cases that we're seeing results in this rapid uptick in hospitalizations. So they're working on combating the virus through mitigation and talking to their state residents and trying to get mitigation of washing your hands, physical distancing, wearing masks, at the same time that they're trying to immunize individuals. So we can see across the South that there's been less vaccinations at the same time they're confronting this virus. And so it's our job to really work with each one of these states and really, and I know right now CDC is working very closely with Georgia to really help them get over some of these structural barriers that we know always occur when we're implementing new programs.
Dr. Birx is with us, and Dr. Birx, as we move into a new month, a new year, should Americans feel optimistic about the course that we are on with the vaccination front?
You know, it's difficult to be completely optimistic. I'm optimistic about the vaccines, if we can get them into the arms of people who need them the most, as well as our frontline healthcare providers. But when you look at what's happening with cases, hospitalizations, and our fatality rates, we need to increase our diligence right now. Over these next 4 to 6 weeks will be very critical. We need to protect one another in new ways because the things that we did in the summer are not working to the same extent that they did in the summer when we were able to mitigate. So we're really asking people to double down on mitigation while we work together to get people immunized.
Why is that? Do we know? Why is it that's not working but it did in the summer?
You know, it's a really great question. Obviously, weather conditions play a role, people moving indoors playing a role, the multiple holidays are playing a role, but also, you know, we're very concerned that the virus is just moving through the population in a different way. And so really asking people to do more than what they did in the spring and the summer personally to really protect each other and their families. Our goal right now that we have vaccines are out in the states, to really make sure that we can get our vulnerable Americans immunized, asking everybody to really protect one another right now while vaccines become available.
Is it realistic for most Americans to expect to receive the vaccine by the first quarter of the first half of this year?
I think what's really important is we get those that we know are very vulnerable to serious disease, those with comorbidities. CDC just added Down syndromes to those difficult and concerning comorbidities. So really making sure the vulnerable Americans are immunized. The rest of us are going to wait our turn. I'm not in any of those frontline categories, so I'm going to wait my turn, but I do hope my parents at 91 and 96 get immunized. And I think those are the sacrifices we're all going to have to make as Americans. Wearing our masks, physical distancing, and keeping our place in line to ensure that those who need it the most get immunized.
Dr. Birx, you have said that you are going to retire at the end of this term. As you look back on your career, which spans decades, and the work that you've done on HIV and AIDS and whatnot, but in particular, what is your biggest regret for the past year in the midst of this pandemic that you wish you could have corrected or done over?
Well, thank you for that question. And what I really said is I would retire after it was clear that the Biden administration had everything they needed, whether that's next month, February, March, or April, that's what it will be. I will return to my home agency, but I certainly want to make sure that the incoming administration is extraordinarily successful. I think this last year, what I learned from going out to states was absolutely crucial. And I wish I had done it in April, because it really changed how we thought about the virus, the policies that we worked with states on, and really the importance of communication at that state level, and really understanding what was making people more vulnerable. From the tribal nations to our inner city African American and Hispanic groups, to really understand how we had to surge testing in a strategic way and in a new way. So those, what I learned in the field going to 44 states and to universities was really essential. It taught us a lot to be on the ground. And I think when many people weren't traveling, that really became critical to understand what governors, what the health individuals were confronting, talking to hospitals and really understanding, and then hearing what communities said and really listening. And that was really critical. And I wish I had gone out towards the end of April.
And I had to follow up, and I have other questions, but to follow up on this, policymakers of all political stripes, yourself included, have received some criticism for what has been not following some of the guidelines that have been put out there. What have you learned from that experience, Dr. Birx, and that you hope policymakers of all political stripes recognize that people are watching, people are listening to what people like yourselves are telling the public to do?
Yeah, first and foremost, what has kept me safe in the 6 months I've been in the field, I think 80, 90 days, nearly 30,000 miles, was following the CDC guidelines. CDC guidelines were our lifeline, and we followed them every day. I really regret how this story was reported. My household has been part of my household for the last many, many decades, and I did have to support my household in Potomac. I have not gathered, and I still haven't gathered. We have four children. I've seen one of them. It's part of that bubble household that I'm a part of. All Americans are making sacrifices. Grandparents are not seeing grandchildren. My parents haven't seen my brother or their grandchildren in over a year. I know Americans are making those sacrifices. We're all making those sacrifices together, and all of us need to continue those sacrifices until everyone is immunized.
How do you hope to be remembered, and how do you hope this team is remembered once America finally turns the corner from COVID-19?
Well, I think, you know, for the last 11 months, I've never made this about me, because that's not what it's about. It's about how, as a administration, as a federal government, we work to support the states, to support the residents of those states. And I think what I know will be true is this will be a historic event that people look at very carefully. There is a written record. People will be able to see what went well, what needs to improve next time. I think I've kept very clear notes on my recommendations of how we need to be prepared for the next pandemic. There's some legislative fixes, but there's some really how our systems work or don't work together that really need to be addressed. And I really hope that sometimes when we get through a crisis, we don't want to fix the things because we've moved past that crisis. Yeah. I think this will be the moment that we really need to address issues that exist, both from health disparities, but also legislative fixes that will be critical for us to be able to have data and accessibility of data in the future.
Two more questions very quickly. First and foremost, what's a memory of the past 11 months that really captures on the front lines as you've traveled the entire country and 44 states, I believe you said? What's a memory that, and I know there's so many, but one's coming to your mind right now as I'm asking this question, of a frontline incident that gives you hope, that gives you optimism, that it illustrates the American spirit?
I think no matter where I went, and no matter whether it was a local county commissioner to a mayor to a governor to tribal leader chairmen, they all shared the fact that they wanted to protect the people that they were responsible for leading. And I think that's what gives me incredible hope and gave me credible hope the whole time I was traveling, is the level of dedication of our local leaders throughout the United States.
And then finally, what's one thing that's kept you going? It could be very practical, like coffee.
The mission. Those who know me,
I am
relentless in completing and working on the mission. And the mission was to try to decrease the impact of COVID-19. And we still need, and that mission is still mission essential over these next few months.
Focused on the mission. That was my conversation earlier today with Dr. Deborah Birx, of course, one of the point people in the U.S. government on the coronavirus. My name is Kevin Cerulli. I'm the Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. Jeannie Sean Zeno is with me, a Bloomberg Politics contributor. She's also, of course, a professor at Iona College and the author of the new book, American Democracy in Crisis. Lester Munson is still with me, principal at the government relations firm BGR Group, previously worked for Bob Corker on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Jeannie, I mean, you hear that interview and you almost hear in her voice how difficult this resurgence of the virus has been.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely fascinating to hear you talking to her today. And we are also hearing today that Vice President Joe Biden, President-elect Biden, has become increasingly frustrated and concerned that his team may not be able to meet the promise of 100 million vaccinations, in part because of what they have described as this sort of mess that has been the COVID response so far. And so it's something that they're increasingly concerned about, and we're hearing a lot of tension on his team as they come forward. And I also thought that one of the last questions you asked in terms of how she hopes to be remembered, and she said she's keeping notes. I hope she writes something so that we can read what this was like from the inside and see what can be done differently next time.
Well, and I thought the exact same thing, and clearly that was a clue for a potential roadmap. But I hope it's and anyone who's in covering her over this past year in particular, she's such an academic, so to speak. And hopefully it will be a playbook for future generations, whether it's 100, 200 years from now, hopefully, in order to prevent some of the horrors of the last year, both from a health standpoint and economic standpoint. You mentioned President-elect Joe Biden. We've got sound on that, which you just alluded to, about him talking about the vaccines. He spoke earlier today. Here's the President-elect of the United States.
My number one priority is getting vaccine in people's arms.
Lester Munson, I mean, you heard the pragmatism, one could argue, from Dr. Birx's perspective about the assessment, the current assessment of the uptick in COVID cases, governors making very difficult decisions again. And then you have the president-elect coming out, as Jeannie just alluded to, and talking about the realities of a very cold winter and a resurgence of the virus, Lester.
Yeah, and this is something that all Americans are wrestling with. We've all got family members and friends who are in the age group where they're vulnerable, or they have, what she calls comorbidities. And so we want to see the people who are vulnerable get protected as quickly as possible. There's this issue of there being different responses in different areas, sometimes down to the county level. Even more granularity than the state level, and good for Joe Biden for saying this is his priority. I think this is something that really matters in people's lives absolutely is as much of an emergency as we can conceive of. And so I think he's entirely correct to prioritize it.
When you hear, I mean, and you having worked in the geopolitical space on the Hill, especially with now former Chairman Corker, I mean, just from your experience in working with Dr. Deborah Birx Lester and your dealings with people of her caliber within the administration and career long, so to speak, careers at the State Department, I mean, how do you think the legacy will be remembered of their handling of this past 11 months?
Well, boy, Kevin, what a great question. I think Debbie Birx is a terrific public servant. She did a terrific job as the coordinator of our international AIDS program. I think she's done a much better job than she's been given credit for on handling COVID-19 and this pandemic. This is an unprecedented event. While there was a bunch of playbooks on the shelf, no one had been through it before. I think the stories that will be written about her years from now will be favorable. And let's not forget, the hostile environment for her was her own administration. You know, the president and some of his key advisors were highly critical of her. They were critical of Dr. Fauci. They were almost undermining them on an hourly basis as they tried to do their jobs. They stuck it out. They're tough as nails. I think all Americans should be thankful for their service.
I mean, and you almost want to say this in terms, Lester, of conducting an interview, and I'll peel back the curtain a little bit here. I'm very curious to the type of interview Dr. Birx would give, and quite frankly, if she's going back to the State Department, I don't think that she would ever give a really candid interview on as you described, the frustrating aspects of the politicization of this virus that she's worked through now for 11 months, Lester.
Yeah, it's and she shouldn't, right? There's she's in a tough spot, but the reason she's respected, the reason she is in this leadership position, and frankly, a leader around the world on infectious disease.
That's important. What do you mean by that? Let's unpackage that, because I think that's very important. And I don't think people understand necessarily the global role that someone like a Debbie Birx plays. Go ahead, Lester.
Well, so as before coronavirus came along a year ago, as she was the head of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which is a critical U.S. government program that has effectively stopped the HIV virus in the developing world. In sub-Saharan Africa and many other places, it saved a generation of humans. Tens of millions of people, and I'm not exaggerating, are alive today because of that program. But for that program, they would not be around. She led that effort. It's a multi-billion dollar effort dealing with other countries, multilateral institutions, other governments. It's incredibly complex and difficult. She led that program. That is the person who runs that program is one of the most important people in the world, because the work that she did and other people who have had that job did saved lives on a regular basis. And I can't emphasize this enough. It's an incredibly difficult job with tons of criticism, tons of decisions every single day. She did that job terrifically. I think she did a good job on coronavirus, better than she's given credit for. And I agree with her that the stories that were written about her and some of her and her personal life were not appropriate. And she has adhered to the guidelines and has done the right thing and has really is exactly the kind of person you want in that kind of job.
All right, let's reset here. My name is Kevin Cerulli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. I'm joined by Bloomberg Politics contributor Jeannie Shawn Zeno, as well as Lester Munson, a Republican geopolitical consultant. And Jeannie, we have to cover this other massive story that has emerged over the past week and really over the weekend. And that, of course, is Twitter removing President Donald Trump's account from its social media platform, and then other platforms like Google and others removing Parler, the conservative social media app, from their app store platforms. And the conversation that has started on freedom of speech, as well as on big tech and on social media. There's been various reports, including by my colleague Jennifer Jacobs, that the president is planning some type of public statement or executive action on big tech regulations in his final week in office. And it's really at the nexus of Silicon Valley and Washington, D.C., Jeannie.
It absolutely is, and we've seen their shares fall as a result. And I think this is a conversation. It has been sort of brought to the forefront in the last several days, last few hours, by the removal of the president and many people who were engaged in those activities last Wednesday. But of course, this is an ongoing conversation around the nexus between Washington, D.C., the government, and of course, all of these social networks, and Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, Amazon. And, we're going to have to be grappling with a lot. There's already a number of lawsuits on the table as the Biden administration comes in. And of course, Congress is going to have its work cut out for it, deciding how it is going to move forward in terms of regulation. And I think there's no question from left or right, there have been calls for regulation for different reasons. Mm. And we're going to see that coming down the pike. And I think there is a school of thought that they acted too late on this. And there's another school of thought that this is empowering individuals who are not elected from big corporations to have a huge say over what kind of information we get in this country. So how we handle that going forward, both legally and in the regulation scheme, is going to be critically important.
Lester, I've struggled with this. I mean, obviously, as a journalist, I believe in freedom of speech. So I guess you're the expert here. My question to you, is it censorship if it's a company removing someone from their organization versus the government silencing a voice?
No, I don't think it is censorship. And I think these private companies, in our system are allowed to make these decisions.
I think this is important because I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to expound on this particular point. You don't think it's censorship. Why? Because in other countries, the governments would if you look at China, for example, a government would silence someone. But in this case, publicly traded companies are saying this is not acceptable, and this is not acceptable voice, for lack of a better word.
Right, but it's not the government saying it. These are private mm-hmm. companies saying it, so they should be judged on that decision. And I'm not saying they shouldn't be criticized at all. But it's not a classic freedom of speech issue. I don't think it is. The president is free to go out and have a press conference. He is free to send out press releases. He is free to try to appear on television. Like he has plenty of ways he can try to communicate if he wants to. He was choosing to spread lies and false narratives on social media, and they decided to shut him down. I think that was probably the right move. But what Twitter and these other companies have to do now is show that is their consistent policy, no matter who is lying. If they're only going to apply it to Trump or only apply it to conservatives, they've got a huge problem. If they're going to apply it across the board to everyone who's involved in political life, making sure that only truthful things are published on their platform, that's a much more sensible place to be for them.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add to that. I think Lester's absolutely right. There's no question this is not a violation of the First Amendment, as we keep hearing. I mean, the First Amendment limits the government. It doesn't limit private companies. But another part of this is something that was talked about well before that, and that is when you have huge corporations that essentially have a monopoly. If they do, and I'm not saying they do, but if they do, these big five, then their options for you to go to another platform are limited. And that's where some of the problems seem to arise, right? Does anybody, the president, any of us else have another place to go if the whole game is Twitter, Amazon, Facebook, and on? So that is another part of this where the government may have to step in if these are determined to be monopolies.
Jeannie Zano, I feel like you could devote a whole semester of classes just on the decision that Twitter made to remove the @real Donald Trump account from their platform. And I have to say this in the last minute that I have left with you both. The first article that I ever wrote back at Politico on Donald Trump was when his Twitter got hacked. And do you remember what song lyrics Does anyone remember? This is a factoid for Tom Keene. Does anyone remember what the Twitter song that he was hacked with? This was back in, oh my gosh, I want to say 2012. Wow. Do you know? Any guesses? Quickly.
Was it something by Sublime?
Nope. What about you, Jeannie?
Oh.
I've got nothing. I don't even know who Sublime is.
Jeannie, sorry, Zato Lester. Doesn't know Sublime? Oh,
I'm sorry, Lester.
I'm baffled at that. No, it was Britney Spears' remix of Scream and Shout. Google it. Kevin Cirilli, Donald Trump, Britney Spears remix, Twitter hacked. Can't make it up. I'm Kevin Cirilli. Thank you, Jeannie. Thank you, Lester. And thank you for listening. Much more coming up throughout the week. Abigail Spanberger, Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.